in association with Newsarama. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today we start a two-part talk with Matt Fraction. We'll discuss his debut book from this week, The Invincible Iron Man, his work on Punisher War Journal, now co-written with Rick Remender, the wrap-up of The Immortal Iron Fist, co-written with Ed Brubaker, and their coming collaboration on The Uncanny X-Men. We'll also discuss his series of one-shots featuring Thor and the Norse gods, his image book Casanova, and wrapping things up on The Order. This episode of Word Balloon is sponsored by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. They offer a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at up to 35% off with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. Among the Fraction trades available, Punisher War Journal Volume 2, Going Out West, regularly retails at $17.99. It's just $11.33 at InStock Trades. And don't forget to visit their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at dcbservice.com for all your pre-order needs. Major publishers are 40% off, and monthly specials are 45 to 75% off every month. Visit InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at dcbservice.com. Well, as usual, we try to talk about nothing but comic books, but Fraction and I can't help it. Good news, though, comic book fans, I left all of our usual back matter on part two, and we'll talk about that a little bit more during the interview, but a really nice talk with Matt discussing his current lineup of books, and there's a ton of them on the newsstand. You should check them all out. But we start things off by talking about the book that debuted this week, The Invincible Iron Man. I want to congratulate you guys because I really think you created an envoy for people who are coming from the movie and want to grab a number one. This very much ties to the movie in terms of its supporting character and tone.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. It was kind of writing by ESP. I didn't have any kind of special access or early access or anything like that to the script or the movie or anything like that. You know, I saw it Friday night like everybody else. I didn't even get to see like early you know, review. So, yeah, it was, you know, me trying to write the kind of Iron Man comic that I hope fit with the kind of movie, you know, with the movie, you know what I mean? So it was sort of like, well, if I was making the movie, it would be something like this. So, I couldn't have been, more excited or happier when I saw the movie. And yeah, I'm glad you felt that way about the book. That was our job. And, it's good to hear that, hopefully we set that landing.
Well, you got Pepper, you got Rhodey, and you have Ace Stain, and it's great that you have taken Ezekiel Stain and from the ashes of the Order, and I'm glad to see that that story was immediately continuing in this first arc of Iron Man.
Yeah, it was never a plan. That implies way too much forethought on my part, but it was, you know, I was working on the Order. I'm putting it together and figuring it out when they had announced that, you know, Jeff Bridges was going to be staying in the movie. I was like, oh, well, you know, he's going to be the bad guy. So I started trying to find a way to bring a staying character back to the Marvel Universe and kind of went back and forth as to whether or not I was going to try and resurrect Dad Stain or give him a son, and ended up going with the son. But so it was always kind of the plan from the beginning that I knew that, you know, A Stain was going to be the big bad in the Order. And that, you know, the general was, you know, one of an army of generals and all that kind of fun stuff. So, and then when I got the Iron Man book, it was like, oh, great, I've already set my villain up, too. Check it out. And I could just kind of bring him over. So, you know, it ended up being like a little treat, hopefully, for people who did, in fact, read The Order. The Order kind of serves as an unofficial prequel to the book and sets us up, you know.
That's really cool. And I liked a lot of the characters in The Order, Matt, and I'm hoping that, you know, that's not the last we'll see of them in Iron Man's world as well.
Yeah, I'm a little, I don't know what the etiquette is on bringing back the characters from your, you know, your own canceled comic. I don't want to, you know, bring up people that nobody wants to hear or read about. But yeah, no, there's the some of the folks that survived the Order are definitely favorites. The Henry character especially, and I love Henry and Tony talking together. So
yeah,
hopefully, I'd imagine Henry will show up before too long.
That's cool. Well, and I don't think you should feel like you're you know crossing any bad you know moves or anything by doing that. I think that's fine, and I think you did create some interesting characters in the Order, Henry in particular, and you know I mean right, he's already got the connection to Tony and Pepper. So I think,
you know,
you know.
As as long as the X-Men, you know, or as long as, like, the Order don't show up in the X-Men.
Exactly.
I think maybe we'll be okay. Suddenly they show up in Iron Fist. It's like, what? What are you doing? They show up in some Thor special that takes place 900 years ago. Suddenly there's the old Order. It just, yeah.
What ho, Henry? What say you?
What ho, also thou?
Let's get back to the first...
Let me write this down before I forget. Thou. Okay, yeah. Moving on.
Back to the first Dark and Invincible Iron Man. I like the five nightmares of Tony Stark. I like that narrative idea. And, I mean, the first one, obviously, him being an alcoholic, but, you know, where did that idea come from as far as, you know, that kind of bulletin point type of thing of here's what Tony fears most?
You know, I had, this book was some weird voodoo for me, where I was sort of pitching for it verbally and not really, you know, I didn't really submit anything in writing. I was pitching it live in the editorial retreat, like in the room, kind of. It was sort of, I knew it was on the, what do you want to call it? Like the agenda.
Okay.
So like I knew we were going to be talking about an Iron Man book and, you know, Bendis sort of at one point said, you know, hey, there's going to be this Iron Man book, if you want it, you know, you should mention that you want it. So I started to kind of mention, hey, I want to do this. And then suddenly there I was kind of pitching on it as it came up. And, part of the thing, I think this is what actually got me the book was I was extraordinarily passionate about it very quickly because the sort of like 2-year storyline came to me right off the bat.
Jeez.
Which I know sounds weird, but like it was sort of like in these discrete arcs, but these four different arcs kind of right away. I was like, oh, you can do this. And I just kind of started to take notes on this piece of, you know, this legal pad and kind of riff my way through it live. And so the kind of the big story with not only Tony having to fight Iron Man 2.0 and Tony Stark 2.0, not just like a different, bigger, you know, version of himself, which is always a little played out, but someone truly, the next, you know, someone that really made Tony look like a dinosaur.
The next Tony Stark, yeah.
Yeah, it really kind of popped up right away, and I had, actually, I have to interject and say that this is actually the second time we're recording this interview. I can't keep the charade up anymore. And you and I are cherry picking our best lines, and like drilling through it. Like this is great. Like I'm actually not this witty. This is sort of vaguely scripted in a weird way.
Well, I'm afraid.
I'm blowing it. I'm telling you, I can't keep the secret anymore.
Well, you know, it's like, you know, trying to tell a joke that you overheard at a cocktail party, but getting it wrong. So no, believe me, I.
Oh, no, but now it's better because now we're sharper. Now we're like, oh, it's just that. But this, it's like we're auto editing out all the ums and uhs. So it's just this is all gold. But my kind of a big part of me writing X-Men is reading Science magazine and trying to stay up on new discoveries and new developments and kind of new frontiers in science. So I've always got this head full of barely understood data that I love to like throw out there and sound a lot more intelligent than I actually am. But I had read this thing about the cell phone versus landlines in the Third World. I was like, that's totally a Tony Stark thing. You know what I mean? That's totally a Tony Stark problem. So
I want to talk about that for a second, though, because that's something that I had heard as well. And it's something that I think, you know, we would take for granted but not realize that, you know, the first phones in the Third World, in a lot of cases, are cell phones.
There's all this sort of discussion, too, about, like, using Coca-Cola as a vaccine distribution network because they're the only people with the depth of transportation and distribution in place. So, you know, that there's a lot of talk about using basically dispensing AIDS vaccines and or rather retroviral eventual AIDS vaccines and retroviral drugs through Coke machines because Coke machines are the one thing that are everywhere.
Yes.
In Africa, you know, so there's all this kind of fascinating like there's a lot of sort of the Third World dealing with Third World problems with First World technology and so yeah, that cell phone thing was just such a cool like wow, that's incredible. So it just went into the vault for about 20 minutes, and then suddenly there was Iron Man. I was like, ah, there you go. So, and the rest just really kind of, you know, I think it was important to me to present Tony as vulnerable right off the bat, as someone who feels fear. You know what I mean? Somebody who has fear. And I think that's sort of every futurist has a fear at the heart of them that is what if I fail? What if I'm wrong? And what if the future is a bummer? You know what I mean?
Sure. Well, and even further, I think most people wait for technology to get cheap before they purchase it, whether it's MP3 players, DVDs. I mean, we've seen it in recent years. And it's interesting that something that consumers just take for granted happens to be one of Tony Stark's worst ideas. And what I like, too, is, as you say, the bigger, better armor has already been done. But what about the cheaper armor that could do potentially as much damage and is affordable
for
anyone?
It's not the bigger, you know, in the end, it wasn't the bigger, better bomb we had to worry about. It was, you know,
the suitcase bomb
takes with box cutters.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's true, too. Yes, you're absolutely right about that.
I mean, and I hate to draw that parallel, so I'm just going to make it as lightly, with as light a hand as possible. I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not doing an allegory or anything like that. But,
no,
you know what I mean? But that's really it. Like it's asymmetry was the key. I wanted to tell a story about how does Iron Man face asymmetry.
What I liked about the story in connection to the film, too, is the paternal attitude that Stain had towards Tony in the film. And I think potentially here, too, you've got that, you know, kind of interesting generation thing. I don't know how your story is going to develop. I've only read the first issue. But I like the idea of the men of different generations and really that resentment on Stain's part that Tony is smarter that we saw in the movie. And again, you know, you're presenting this different attitude now of the young up-and-comer who clearly feels like he's much smarter than Tony. And I like the example that you showed of him wiping out all the tobacco guys as well.
Yeah. Well, and first off, and this is my favorite line of last night, tobacco executives are the new Nazis. You can kill them without guilt, without remorse, in huge volume. I'm going to thank you for laughing at it again.
Well, I still like it.
Yeah, there's invariably, I was noticing this tonight, that I tend to, I don't have, like, real issues with my dad, but I'm really interested in dad issues. Like, it comes up in my writing again and again and again. But yeah, clearly I enjoy writing characters with dad issues and both Stain and Stark have their own fair share. In the third issue, I do a kind of like a brisk recap of who Obadiah Stain was in the comics.
Okay.
It's sort of like a little two-page recap of who he was and how he came about, what trouble he caused for Tony and how he went out. And it's such a berserk story that of course a guy like his son is going to have profound father issues. So, yeah, I think it invariably, whether Tony is a surrogate father or whether, you know, Tony's going to be working his own father issues out sort of through the son of his nemesis, and, you know, everybody's got their own psycho-emotional baggage that they'll be dealing with and inflicting on each other.
Wow, Matt, I think outside of Frank Castle, everybody else you're running does have father issues. Thor. Iron Fist.
Thor, and it was Thor.
Casanova.
When I was thinking about Thor, and I was like, wow, it's just, I need to have a scene where, like, Odin is like, fathers and sons. It always comes down to fathers and sons.
That's outstanding.
And this is that moment of me kind of speaking through the character. But, yeah, no, everybody has dad issues. Or discovers dads they didn't know they had and then develops dad issues in the case of Iron Fist.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I want to talk about Thor and Iron Fist and everything, but while I'm still on Iron Man, I've got to acknowledge Salvador LaRocca because I really loved that annual that you guys did last year on Spider-Man.
Thank you, sir. It was
a great story, and it was beautifully drawn. And I'm really happy. I think Salvador's, you know, already proven in one issue that he is going to be a great Iron Man artist as well.
Yeah. He just, from page one, swung for the bleachers. You know what I mean?
It was
great. Just the minute we got our first page in, it was just like, oh, okay, so Sal is going to completely invent his A game and then bring it. Great, okay.
That's true.
Couldn't be happier. Wait till the next issue when you get to see MODOG.
Always happy to see MODOG.
I was just going to write this scene with Tony fighting AIM, and we got this Salva Types in all caps.
Okay.
Which is kind of a funny way if you imagine what, I don't know what, I've never met the man, but so in my head he always like.
Screaming?
He always speaks in caps. Hello, I am Salvador. I got this email. Will he be fighting MODOK? And Warren and I were like, wow, that's a pretty great idea. So.
That's awesome. Oh, that's great.
But it's MODOK because it's advanced genocide mechanics. He's a mechanized or a mental organism designed only for genocide.
Oh.
MODOK. But it's still Salvador Locro trying, you know, MODOK. Just like, oh, Jesus Christ. I can't believe I get paid for this.
That's outstanding. That's great, man. Well, no, it's a great start. And, like I said, happy to see Pepper and Rhodey as part of the story. And is it going?
I love Pepper and Tony together. I love Pepper and Tony together.
How will this tie into Secret Invasion? Or will it at all?
I don't know.
Okay.
Honestly, that's going to depend on a couple of schedules. At the moment, there's sort of faint plans. My original idea was that the first arc, which is 6 issues, would happen, and then sort of Secret Invasion would fall between that. So then our second arc picks up with post-Secret Invasion status quo.
Okay.
But with the sort of vagaries of scheduling and realities of workloads and stuff, we might build in a kind of a mini arc there that might take advantage of Secret Invasion. At this point, I just want to kind of get through the end of this first arc and get my head around sort of some stuff, and we'll see what happens. So we should know maybe in a month or two if we're going to tie into Secret Invasion, and I'm sure we'll announce it everywhere possible.
That's cool. I can't believe that 5 years ago, and here's something else we said last night, that, you know, really, Marvel wasn't sure what to do with Iron Man. It really seems like before Warren came around, there really was just so many ideas being thrown against the wall. I heard a really interesting idea about Iron Man, and this is, I guess, how far things had gotten. Nunzio DeFilippis and Christina Weir were telling me on a previous interview that they were thinking about, you know, a pitch where Tony dies and becomes part of the Iron Man armor, and a woman even becomes Iron Man. And that was, you know, thrown out as a potential pitch. So it's really interesting to see that, you know, things were that kind of aimless in terms of what do we do now with Tony Stark to where we are today, where there is room for two books. They are two great books. The Knopfs are doing wonderful work. And this is a great addition as well. And Tony has really kind of, thanks to the creative minds over in Marvel, everybody's kind of figured out a new purpose for Tony and a new direction for the character.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where sometimes, like, characters just get so much kind of baggage attached to them, whether it's like, real baggage, like, this, you know, or it's just kind of no one can, you know, Cloak and Dagger are one of those characters that, like, everybody seems to want to pitch and everybody seems to want to do, but the right pitch hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor Strange is another one, where it seems like everybody wants to do a Doctor Strange story, but it's sort of hard to get traction going on anyone. You know what I mean? Just sometimes characters acquire, you know.
I hear what you're saying. No, I hear what you're saying. But I almost wonder, too, and here's a different discussion. I think there are certain characters that are just B-level characters and are good for the occasional miniseries if someone has an individual idea. But there are also so many characters that just can't sustain an ongoing series. And I always wonder why they try.
I think I'm a big proponent actually of what they did with Thor.
Yes.
I think there's nothing wrong with, now I've been sort of laughed at when I bring this up, because, you know, there's sort of bottom lines and other such real world issues. But, you know, I'm a big fan of, like, let's let the character cool off for a while, you know?
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the things that, you know, like I'll, Ed and I were talking not long ago, Brubaker, about him following Brian on Daredevil.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, like I couldn't do it. You know, I don't want to follow Ed on Daredevil. Jesus Christ, you know. But so the things like put the character on ice for a year, give the character a year off. You know, put him in the penalty box and let him sort of let everybody miss him, and then bring him back. You know, I mean, look at what that did for Thor. Now, you know, you'll see one of the biggest writers in the business, one of the most talented artists in the business, and, you know, one of the biggest characters in the business, you're going to have a huge book like Thor. But, you know, I think that there's something to be said for letting a character cool off, and that sort of let's perpetuate the trademark kind of notion. Doesn't necessarily always serve the trademark in the long run, you know?
Yeah.
But then again, that's easy for me to say, because it's not my company.
Yeah, not your toy box. I understand.
they're not my shareholders. So,
let's talk about the movie for a second because we haven't really yet.
Sure.
And I mean, I'm assuming you were as blown away as I was. I really can't. I don't think there was a false note in that film, and that was really great to see.
Yeah. No, I loved it. I really loved it. It was. You know, the worst thing I can say, and this is minor, but you know the only time the movie even remotely disappointed was when the movie sort of became like movies like that, where, like, invariably it became about, like, the good guy and the bad guy have to fight now.
Yeah,
you know what I
mean?
And that's just sort of like that. And, like, really, that's the worst. That's the only criticism that I can come up with. You know what I mean? And that's hardly a criticism at all, you know? I didn't want it to end.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. And you're right. I mean, the fight scenes were fine, but there were so many other great moments. And just him flying around. Just his perspective of being inside the armor and having the sentient armor. And I like the idea of making Jarvis the ghost
Jarvis,
of the machine.
Yeah. Let me tell you about there's an actual acronym.
Yes.
It's like just a really virtual intelligence system or something like that. It has, like, Jarvis stands for something. Like, I think in the video game, it comes up in the video game.
That's great.
But no, you know, like that's always such a lame critique when, like, you're like, my one complaint is there wasn't enough. like that was the first couple issues of Warren Ellis's upcoming Astonishing X-Men run.
Okay.
Like that was like my note from the first issue was like the only thing I could literally the only thing I was like, oh God, I wish there was more. Like, that's not a valid note. that's a stupid thing to say and a waste of time. And you shouldn't bother people with such things.
No, I'm trying to think. I mean, you know, even Gwyneth Paltrow, who was kind of disappointing in, and I always get the name of the movie wrong. Was it Sky Captain? Yeah, Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow.
Which I didn't actually see.
Oh, man, she was so one note in that movie. And this movie, she actually had a personality, and I thought she was really good. And also, you know, whenever they have, like, a blonde playing a redhead or whatever, it's always like, can't you find a good-looking redhead? It's like, is it that hard? But, I mean, she was great as Pepper, and, God, I thought Favreau was very funny as Happy Hogan. And I loved how Happy Hogan was very surly and really kind of very deadpan.
Yeah, and you know, again, another line from last night. But how brilliant is it that Favreau casts himself as the guy who marries Gwyneth Paltrow? spoilers, I guess, for people who haven't read Iron Man. But that'd be great. You know, suddenly it's like long. You know,
that's got to suck. By the way, that Happy's dead and you can't use him. That's the only thing I would have to say about the Knopfs and everything. Where it's like, oh, did Happy have to die?
Yeah, I it was such a great boy. It was good. You know what I mean? It was such a wonderful. It was handled so well, and it
was.
You know, it gave Civil War such a real price tag, such a real emotional weight. It's a bummer, and he's a great character. But what a compliment to the Knopfs that, like, God, I never thought I would miss Happy Hogan.
See,
but I do, and it was a terrific, and I love the ambiguity of the death. The just everything was just terrific. There's a moment coming up in our second arc about Happy that I'm super happy about.
Cool.
Happy might be gone, but he's definitely not forgotten.
That's cool. Well, you know, I just think that the heroes are stronger when they have a good Greek chorus around them. And I really, you know, there's a reason why Jimmy Olsen and Lois Lane and Perry White are still around. And it's when they're used right, they're great sounding boards. And Brew is showing that in Captain America. I mean, you've got an entire, just the whole Greek chorus, just chanting Steve and everything. And it's just compelling to read. And I always felt that way about Ben Urich, too, in Daredevil. I mean, it's just, you know, and Foggy, for that matter. It's, you need those strong citizens, just people on the street, that can really cut through the mask and just talk to the guy and say, look, you know, I'm your friend. I don't care about the Iron Man thing. This is what I see. And that's what I always loved about Happy.
Yeah, and that's always the sort of the best for me, too. You know, Happy had that sort of Ben Grimm kind of
absolutely.
Streetwise kind of guy. You know what I mean?
Yep.
He so wasn't from Tony's world. That there's always such a great kind of salt and pepper magic they made together. So,
yeah, and Rhodey fills that role as well. And I know I asked Mickaleen when I spoke to him, you know, where did Rhodey come from?
Is that how you say his name?
Well, I think it is Michelini, actually. I'm probably saying it wrong. Because he did explain it to me, and I, you know, you fall into bad hands. Well, Miller Millar. I mean, it's, you know, you're an ass. I mean, you can't help it. It's like, you read it for how many years and stuff, but I believe it is Michelini. I think you're right. So, I'm assuming, obviously, you're a fan of the Leighton Michelini run.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think you have to be.
Hell yeah.
It's so great. But no, it's, I'm always embarrassed when I mispronounce people's names. I'm so bad with names. When I manage to get names wrong, it's like, oh God. And when I today I did this big Iron Man signing, and even today when I personalize people's books, I still like ask, like, how do you spell that? Bob, B-O-B, like two B's. Like, I'm so worried I'm going to get names wrong.
So. How many copies fly off the shelves, man?
145, I was told.
Nice.
Not a bad day.
I think this print run will sell out. I mean, I don't know what.
I believe it already did.
Well, there you go. God, that reminds me of, remember, I don't know if you were reading back then, but when Steve Grant and Mike Zeck did Circle of Blood, the Punisher thing, I remember that Wednesday coming in, and it's like, yeah, can I get that? They're like, no, it's already sold out. I'm like, it's noon. You just opened up. What the hell's going on? Now we're already sold out.
Yeah, I got an email around 1 in the afternoon saying, hey, it's about to sell out. And then the shop I was at, the guy didn't. The guy wanted more sort of by lunch rush. He was in sort of dire supply straits. And he called Diamond and they were like, yeah, that we're sold out. So,
wow.
I'm pretty crazy.
Pop the champagne, Kelly Sue. Nice going.
It's a champagne night for us, baby.
Yeah. It's going to be an Aviance night. Nice. Rianiti on ice. Fantastic,
exactly.
Man.
So nice.
Well, let's move on. Let's talk about Thor, because that was outstanding. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much.
Very funny.
So fun to write that book.
And once again, dipping from last night, I must point out the narration was outstanding. And in my mind, and I didn't ask you if you had a voice in your head, and you probably have millions of voices in your head, but for the specific narrator, I heard John Huston as the lawgiver in the Planet of the Apes movies, kind of, and it was foretold.
And now that is all I'm going to be able to think when I write the book is John Huston.
Good. And Thor one day spoke to Loki, and he said, in that great kind of creepy grandpa voice. Grandpa's been taking too much of the bourbon lately. Man. All right, meanwhile, all the comic fans are really pissed that we've chosen this moment in the middle of the thing to start our usual movie tangents.
Yeah,
So, all right, so kids, we're sorry.
Thor,
Agents of Thunder.
Man with a hammer and dad issues.
And three really good little myths. And I think it's interesting that you said that you didn't know how to handle Thor for the longest time. And, I think you've obviously got the handle now based on these stories, because they were wonderful tales of Asgard, which was always my favorite feature of Thor when they would do those backup stories.
Yeah, and there's this sort of amazing thing to Stan and Jack's run on Thor, and even more so as Jack kind of took the book over, as you get into like the third volume of the Essentials, where they would kind of edit the myth. Like, yeah, you know, this story beat doesn't really work for me. And suddenly characters would change and, you know, myths and stuff would change. So the cycle of the three sort of one-shots that we're doing now really kind of was born of that. Like, let's just play around with some myths, and we get the stuff that doesn't work, we'll get rid of it. And that's really, you kind of see these melange of different myths being assembled. But, yeah, the Tales of Asgard stuff, and sort of Stan and Jack when they were selectively dipping from the real well of Norse mythology, that was kind of that, you know. And just once I wanted to have the hubris to, you know, rewrite 2,000-year-old myths. Well, really, what bad can happen when you fuck around with sacred texts?
Well, I like the Frost Giants, and I think they had more character in this story than I've ever seen them, because they always were kind of just, you know, like, oh, here comes the army of zombies and stuff. I mean, Frost Giant zombies, same thing. But I really kind of like that you really gave a lot of personality to the one in particular who even accepted his fate as, you know, look, I know I'm going to be mowed down by these Asgardian gods. I don't care.
Right, but I'm going to go out drilling the Enchantress.
And, you know, hey, wouldn't we all like to go out that way?
Especially the way that a Zerker draws her. But yeah, no, it's this kind of big, you know. And the other thing too is the Norse myths are bawdy and violent and sexual and like lusty, and you know what I mean. They're sort of like stories that pirates would tell each other.
Sure.
This great kind of, you know, and just to kind of tap into that kind of raw elemental bigness, and that was kind of just an opportunity. That was really what, you know, that was my way into Thor was seeing an inked Kirby page from Journey into Mystery for the first time, and kind of discovering in some weird psychic way, where it was sort of on weird, some weird psychic level, I should say, like that raw power. It seems like seeing like kind of naked Kirby art, you get Kirby in a way that maybe you haven't gotten before, at least I did. And suddenly Thor made sense to me in a way that he never had. So that was what I wanted to do with this book, is kind of honor that enormity, that sort of power and scope. So, and have a little fun, you know, and brain a lot of frost giants with a hammer while I'm at it, because who doesn't like to see that at least once or twice?
Sure. And this is, you know, a young Thor, young out-of-control Thor that, you know, kind
of... It's very much Thor is asshole teenager.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's just as kind of decadent and jacked up as everybody else in Asgard, but he thinks his shit doesn't stink, and he's kind of antisocial and kind of a pain in the ass and sort of stuck up. And, you know, that was one of my you know, the sort of, this is ultimately these three stories will come together and it'll retell a sort of why Odin sort of cursed Thor with Donald Blake. We're sort of seeing Thor's pride and hubris go with before the fall, I suppose you could say.
Sure. But I also like the idea, too, that, you know, with the Golden Apple story in particular, that, you know, everyone is, you know, munching away and stuff. And was that really from the myth that, like, Thor...
Yeah. The myth was Eden, or Idun, I-D-U-N, was the only Asgardian who could harvest these golden apples. And it was the golden apples that gave the Norse gods their vitality and beauty and power. And there was indeed a story where she was kidnapped and the apples couldn't be picked and the gods were starving.
And only Thor had them?
No, that I kind of made up.
Okay, because I like that.
Because I needed Thor to sort of still be powerful. So that was like, oh, that seems like a prick thing to do. Like, I'm going to hoard the golden apples and I'm not going to share when you guys need them. So, but you know what I mean? So like I said, I'm rewriting it.
Your father demands his readings, Thor.
Norway.
Yeah, I know.
Been Man of Steel.
Say that again, because I actually talked over you there.
Sorry, Norway. You've just been Man of Steel.
Very nice. So, you know, I remember you saying, too, that potentially the third book might be a future look at Thor, but you said that's kind of been abandoned. And
I think I'm kind of dialing back on that. I didn't have a clear enough vision. It was sort of like a vague art direction, and to really pull off like a story that takes place over like 8,000 years, you really need to have more than like, okay, so stuff looks a little newer, which tended to be about as deep as I got. So ultimately, my dream of doing Thor as a 50-story robot fighting Odin as a sort of sentient moon descending upon Earth to destroy it, it's destined to become a dream deferred, I suppose.
But, okay.
It's still sort of, you know, I'll figure something out. It'll still kind of make sense. But I just think I'm dialing back on that initial kind of approach just for simplicity's sake.
Okay. Well, let's stay in the myth world and talk about the wrap-up on Iron Fist.
Sure thing.
I'm sorry that you guys are leaving, and I know that you have been... Your hands have been on the wheel a little bit more in these you know, last few issues. I'm happy that Dwayne is taking over the book, but
he's a terrific writer, and that's you know, first and foremost, above all else, he is a great A writer. We definitely thought he was a great idea to take over, and we were both really excited to see what he would do. And then I actually got to read his proposal for his first arc and was hooked. You know, I Iron Fist to me was sort of like a girlfriend in a bad breakup. When I was done,
sure,
I wanted to be done. I didn't want to go back to it. I didn't want to see it. I didn't want to think about it. You know, I wished Iron Fist well, but I'd done my time and didn't want to know. and then I read his pitch and I was like, son of a bitch. So I'm still an Iron Fist reader, much to my delight and surprise. I'm still reading Iron Fist, and I can't wait to see what he does with it.
That's cool. Well, let's talk about what you guys did with it. It was a great 14 issues, and I was really happy because I remember when this was first proposed, and I remember seeing on message boards people saying, yeah, this thing's no way, this is going to suck, or
right,
whatever.
Right. People were the same way that people responded to the order and predicted for the order, which they were accurately predicting for the order, were inaccurately predicting for the
people didn't think that Iron Fist would work, in an ongoing. And I knew, hearing you and Brew talking about it, that you guys were so excited about the character and knew what made him great in those flashes of times when, you know, Claremont and Byrne were doing it, and when, you know, I even like the Deadly Hands of Kung Fu black and white stories that...
I like that. I think that's some of the best. That is without a doubt, some of the... that stuff is just terrific. I like that stuff more than really the Iron Fist solo series.
Yeah.
Because it's just a little bit more adult, you know, and those magazines, Marvel pushed the boundaries just a little bit more. So it was a little more violent, a little more out there, a little more trippy.
Definitely.
Good stuff.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's certainly seemed to be the hallmark of what your guys' run was, especially in this second arc. You know, the tournament just kept getting crazier and crazier, and I like the fact that it ended with all the champions now in New York.
Yeah, you know, they're such fun characters. And even Davos. I mean, it was one of those books where, at the end, you're just like, everybody's so much fun to write. Everybody's such a rich kind of, like, you know, we got to play with such a rich tapestry. So, I'm 15 is another one shot, and then 16 is our sort of swan song issue.
Oh, I didn't realize there were going to be two more issues.
Yeah. 15 is sort of like 7 was, where it's like a standalone sort of here's another story of another Iron Fist.
Oh, very cool. What period of time are we looking at for that Iron Fist?
That is Bai Bang Wen, who was in, I think, the 3rd issue of Iron Fist, and it's during the English War, the first Opium War fought in India with England. 16 is called Happy Birthday, Danny, and it's a special birthday for Danny.
I wanted to ask, too, now that I'm thinking of it, that last annual, was it an annual that came out?
I think we called it a special.
Man, that was a great story, too.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I'm always happy to see more Orson Randall stories, so that, you know.
Yeah, I would, you know, drop everything to write a Orson, like, Knights or Mac series where I could just kind of go nuts. it always kind of comes up as if I'm kind of joking and I'm kind of not joking, sort of.
No, man, hey, you know, I think that, especially that time period, that pre-timely.
That sort of Marvel, yeah, that pre-timely stuff where there's not a lot of, kind of, like, defined Marvel history, and he could sort of just do anything, and, you know, it's just such a cool, like you just invent an entire world out of this stuff.
Well, and that League of Extraordinary Gentlemen that you, and forgive me, I forget your title
for the Confederates of the Curious.
Thank you, the Confederates of the Curious. No, I love that, and I remember.
It's just, yeah, I can't believe I get paid to write sometimes.
No, that's a blast, and also I kept pushing Brew, and I'm like, Orson should meet the original Union Jack, Lord Fallsworth, back when he was fighting Baron Blood back in the 20s or whatever. And he's like, yeah, sure, Jim. Good luck to you. I'm sorry you guys are going, but it sounds like we got two more issues to enjoy before you guys leave, so that's cool.
Yeah, and I think we ended in a good place, and it's been a great run, and you know, it, the idea of leaving it really scared me, so I felt like it was the right thing to do. Ed was leaving kind of officially at the end of this arc, and David was, David's had a kid, and so he's got to dial back for a while, so David was leaving officially, and it just sort of was like, well, why are we staying? What do we hope to gain? And we said, this was, another one that we said last night, but, if the Clash had quit after London Calling, they'd be the greatest band of all time. If there was no Sandinista and no Combat Rock, everybody would speak of the Clash, they'd just really be the greatest band. So we're going to have 3 wonderful trades that, with some of the most, with some legends, real verifiable, bona fide legend of comics, and we just couldn't be happier. So rather than keep going and, be thought of as the guy who ruined Iron Fist, once Brubaker left, or rather have Ed be called, have Ed be saddled with it, let's go out on a high note. Let's go out without people saying, yeah, that book used to be good. So.
Well, and I'm hoping Dwayne will be able to continue the tradition, and it sounds like, I know you're excited about it, and
his pitch had me from the first paragraph. It's such a strong opening hook that I'll follow that book anywhere now.
That's cool. Maybe someday Greg Rucka too. And again, not to diminish Dwayne's run, but I'd love to see, you know, guys like you guys be able to keep carry this thing along. And Dwayne's got a novel career, and that's the only reason why I say, you know, I don't want to look too far ahead. But
are you as excited as I am to see that Ed and Greg are working together on Daredevil?
Hell yes.
Man, it's going to be some good comics.
Well, and, you know, let's use that moment to transition to your continuing writing collaboration with Ed on X-Men, because how is that different from the way you guys were doing things on Iron Fist?
Right. Well, with this, we've basically put together the super arc of the kind of these you know, 25, 30 issues, however many are kind of this sort of initial salvo of plans is going to be, or our initial plan salvo is going to be. It's been a long day. And rather, whereas Iron Fist, it was much more sort of collaborative. We're just basically switching arcs off.
Okay.
So I'll be doing, you know, the first, I like 501, 500 we did together. And I do 501, 2, and 3. And then Ed comes in, I believe, after that for an arc, which I think will be 3 or 4 issues. So yeah, it's sort of, but it's very much like we sort of talked about the big plot stuff together, and that we've organized and arranged together. But the actual kind of execution is very independent of one another.
Okay.
And it's really the way that the series is built now. There's not necessarily a core team, but a very big ensemble. So characters will kind of come and go as we need them. So Colossus might have a big part in 501 and through 503, but then maybe Ed doesn't need him and wants to use, you know, a Beast for a while. So it kind of, you know, characters come and characters go, because the whole kind of open is the mutants kind of adopt San Francisco as their new home, and sort of set the word out that all mutants, sort of past and present, can come to San Francisco and be with their kind. San Francisco really welcomes them and really kind of opens its doors to them. It doesn't view them as a menace or a threat, but as a kind of exotic novelty, and one that San Francisco is very easily, very eager to celebrate. So it was a big, big cast, and we're going to play with people coming in and taking off at our leisure, and see what happens.
That's cool, and we discussed this last night. You, Brubaker told me about his time living in San Francisco and just that mentality of how reverent people still are of the houses that the Grateful Dead used to like live in and stuff.
Yeah. I had a friend who actually lived not quite around the corner from that, but basically around the corner from that house. And it's still there. You know what I mean? It is a town unlike any other. It really is.
Well, and Ed was even telling me that the current owners really kind of have to, you know, not be mean, but it is their house, like kind of shoot people off sometimes. And
yeah, exactly. No, please don't smoke weed on my front porch. I have a 9-year-old kid. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Or, and then them complaining and saying, man, you're like making me leave God's church, man. This is my church. And it's no, it's a house that a band used to live in, but I understand.
Go away. That once contained a lot of venereal disease. But yeah, you know, who doesn't want to see the X-Men in that environment?
Well, but I like the kind of commune idea as opposed to what the mansion was. When the mansion was the school, and that's where everybody was. And
right.
This
and
kind
and
of is more.
Forget, it's a giant X. It's a giant target where these people have been hunted and killed time and time and time again. And how many dead kids are they going to have to hose off the front lawn before everyone decides it's kind of a bummer to see that fucking place every day?
But
so
yeah, this
that's
is
ultimately the decision. They get, as you can see in Ed's storyline, they're in San Francisco, and they sort of decide that maybe being in a place that hates our guts, maybe we should go somewhere that wants us to be here.
Well, and I like the idea too that San Francisco is important again in the Marvel Universe, because I remember when Danny O'Neill sent Daredevil and Black Widow to San Francisco
for a while. The only guy that remembers, you and Ed. But yeah, no, exactly. And you know, that's one of the things, too, that I kind of got into with the Order, and that was sort of initially where the idea came from, was, like, I'm really enjoying writing, you know, like, not being beholden to New York.
Sure.
There's kind of some cool stuff we can do if we, you know, and I knew the Order was going to be sort of wrapping up, so it's like, well, what if we move to California? And I believe it was Ed's idea, like right away, like, you know, of course San Francisco, and it's like, that's just so perfect.
What you've described in terms of what's coming up and just the framing of the story. And honestly, Ed's last story has me reading Uncanny. I'm not an X-Men fan. I like the core characters, But, you know, I just think, you know, what I think of the core characters, I can only think of about 10. And I know that every hardcore X fan, you know, is like, there's at least 50. It's these fresh ideas that I think are going to make me want to read the X-Men. So I look forward to what you're going to be doing. And I have been enjoying what Ed's been doing as well.
Right on. Right on. I hope you like it. And it's you know, it's definitely the kind of X book we want to read. You know, there are a lot of advantages to working with a guy like Axel Alonso and Nick Lowe, the editors. And one of them is they are not what you would consider precious about the material.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are story editors first and foremost, and they're looking for emotional moments. You're looking for character moments. You're looking for real moments. You're looking for story above all else. So, you know what? If we don't want to do a Phoenix story, then damn it, there's no reason you should do a Phoenix story. It's very, as a writer, it's a very satisfying place to be.
Which X-Men are you finding, you know, a joy to write that you maybe didn't think you would find yourself writing before?
Emma is great.
Okay.
Emma, I love right off the bat. Emma has been wonderful. I really, really, really like Scott. Especially where sort of Scott is going, sort of mentally, in the wake of Messiah Complex and Divided We Stand.
Mm-hmm.
Scott is great. Scott is always, for my taste, been the axis of the book, sort of the moral center of the book. And I think when the Book of the X-Men is finally closed and people look back on it, it'll be clear that it's Scott's story.
Absolutely.
So to write him, and he's in, I don't want to give too much away, but sort of where he's at is horrific. He's a really exciting and really, really engaging character to write. And then Pixie, the character Pixie, is coming in as our sort of, you know, every X-team, every X-era seems to have a prepubescent girl, or a teenage girl, I should say, that is really sort of the
coming of age.
Yeah, it's sort of like the lens through which the stuff is viewed. And Pixie is ours, and she has been a blast so far. She was one of my favorites from Craig Kyle and Chris Yost's run of stuff.
Cool.
I loved her character, and that we got to bring her with us to San Francisco and kind of make her the mascot, sort of the new Jubilee, the new Shadowcat. It's been great. I've been having a lot of fun with her arc so far.
That's great. Well, and I am a Cyclops fan, so I'm glad to hear that Scott is, you know, kind of at the center of what you guys are doing, because I agree. That is one of the things that kind of kept me away from the X-Men all those years, when I'd hear, oh, you know, well, Cyclops is a dick, and it's like, oh, really? You know, that's too bad. I always like Cyclops. I agree. I think he sometimes the burden of being the leader, you know, wore too hard on him, depending on who was writing it. But I always just kind of felt that he was the character of the X-Men, the original five. He was certainly the one that was the most interesting to me.
Yeah,
so.
And you know, and now you know the whole thing is there's 200 mutants.
Yeah,
less than 200 mutants or whatever it is.
198 or whatever it is now.
There's this baby.
Right.
That he has sent to the future to escape, you know, that he believes is, we've seen him as arrogant, we've seen him as uncertain, we've seen him as inexperienced and naive, and we've seen him as overconfident, we've seen him as brash, we've seen him having nervous breakdown after nervous breakdown, but where he's at now is he's having to explore faith for the first time. Faith that he's right. You know, this is like the dream is over. Xavier's dream is no more. It's no longer a relevant paradigm to which to view the world. So it's Scott's dream in a way, and it's Scott's dream, and the future of mutantdom is on the line. And so we're having to see Scott as a man of faith who has to put his beliefs in action in a way that he's never had to before, and it puts him through this kind of really. Like it's one thing when, oh, gosh, I have to beat the X-Men. It's another thing when, oh, gosh, I have to keep our species alive. And that's ultimately, those are the stakes he's dealing with, is every decision I make, the future of mutant kind is on the fucking line. And that just puts him, like, there are no higher stakes. You know what I mean? You don't walk it off if you're wrong. You don't shake it off. You don't get to, well, we'll lick our wounds, X-Men, and be back tomorrow. This is it. And they're gone. you know, mutants can't, you know, if you're a mutant, you can't afford to get, like, sloppy drunk one night and go hang out with your friends, because if you cross the street without looking, get hit by a bus, there's one less mutant in the world. You know, you can't, you know, it's just, this is this incredibly high, incredibly dangerous sort of stake involved with being a mutant right now, and that's it. Every mutant life is precious, and Scott has put himself in the position, or rather Scott finds himself in the position of being the one there to ensure that somehow, some way, against hope, against science, more mutants come, that somehow more mutants happen, and that's like, wow. Like, that's a problem, man. That's a big place. That's a big place to have your head.
Absolutely. Wow, man, you got that. You've got Iron Man kind of dealing with, I don't know where Secret Invasion is going and how that will change the status quo of Civil War and stuff, but, you know, Iron Man is really certainly kind of has a different responsibility with the superheroes, but in this, you know, another weighty, only I can kind of handle this job responsibility.
Yeah. Well, the magic of Iron Man's personality is he believes that he always believes that he's the only one who can handle the job.
That's true.
But in Scott's case, it's actually true. It's these characters are the most fun when you're really putting them through the ringer, you know. They're the most fun to write when you're really giving them seemingly insurmountable odds. You know, you really get to see what they're made of.
Absolutely.
Yeah. When there's no crane on the edge of the cliff for the character to you know, go diving for as the car goes careening off of it. Like, all right, man, we're going over the cliff. Let's see what happens.
All right. I want to get to Punisher War Journal, but before I do, I know next week wraps up the Casanova arc.
Yeah.
So I want to give you an opportunity now to kind of, you know, trumpet that.
It's the end of our second storyline, Casanova 14, about May 14th. I think it is the best thing I've ever written. I think Casanova Volume 2 is the best thing I've ever written. And it's sort of everything is revealed. Every question that has been asked is answered. Every mystery is solved. And, you know, some people live, some people die. Nothing's the same. And everybody has to pay the piper a little bit.
Well, and I don't know how many people listening are only fans of yours through your Marvel work and how many people have been on the ride, you know, going back to Last of the Independents and Rex Mantooth and some of the crazy shit you've done in the past. But really, it's, you know, Full Metal Fraction. If, you know, the comparison is if you like the Jinx World stuff of Bendis, if you like Criminal and Low Life and some of the things that, you know, Sleeper, some of the things that Brew has done that haven't been, you know, with mainstream heroes and stuff, Casanova is really, you know, inside the mind of Matt Fraction.
It's definitely there's no chaser, that's for sure.
And
I dislike her. I'm somehow not entertained by the Marvel stuff.
Not at all.
Casanova is its own thing.
There's no boundaries in Casanova, and I think that's one of the things that I love about it, and that, you know, just like the mental, you know, trivia pool that we were just playing before when we were thrown back between John Huston and Orson Welles, it's those kinds of references that are peppered all through Casanova that I think just make it fun for me and any pop culture fan that really,
it's full of that stuff. And it's one of those things where it's somehow a piece of work that has somehow become like a work journal. You know what I mean? I can always tell what I was looking at, what I was reading, what I was thinking about, what was going right in my life, what was going wrong in my life when I go back and read it. And there's all kinds of, you know, I don't know, it's just this is sort of all kinds of little signals to other people like me. You know what I mean? Just little sort of, hey, you know what I mean? Just you send these little signal flares up to see if you can find anybody else that's in your tribe. And sometimes signal flares come back, and it's just, there's nothing quite like it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. No, and what I love, too, is you and Warren Ellis and Ben Temple-Smith and Fabio and Gabriel, your collaborators on Casanova specifically, you guys have taken the 16-page format that you've set up at Image, and, you know, for only $1.99, there is so much story in each issue. And, you know, in addition to something you only get in the floppies, and that's, you know, the back matter and the commentary that really does, you know, as you say, helps you, you know, helps the reader see where you were in your life as you've been writing this story. And it gets pretty personal.
Rather than, you know, expound upon you know, my genius and my brilliance, no. And, you know, how smart I am, how clever I am, and how dumb all of you are until I came along to help you and show you the way, that the best thing to talk about in the back of Casanova was the simplest stuff, that kind of surface. This is what I was listening to. This is what I was thinking about. You know what I mean? Just basic sort of, you know, I likened it at one point like buttons on a backpack, you know? Oh, what bands do you like? Oh, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, you sort of you make your way through high school, and you can always kind of discover people that you get along with based on what buttons they were wearing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I was, like, we moved around a lot, and I always made it a thing where my first day of school, I'd wear a comic book T-shirt, so any other comic book nerds would, you know who I was.
That's awesome.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, as
absolutely.
Kind of, you sort of, you send up that signal flare.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I did a thing with, I did a job in Tokyo once, and it was one of the best pitch meetings I ever had, where it was me and pitching our company, and a Japanese art director of some tremendous renown, who didn't speak a word of English, and a translator, and like a bunch of stern-faced Japanese advertising executives, and me and a couple of people from my company, and I'm trying to... We're trying to get this job, and I'm pitching to this guy, like, trying to find that universal, like, design language. Like, I believe we can speak to each other. I don't need to know Japanese, and you don't need to know English. Although he did speak a little bit of English.
Okay.
Two things. He said three things in English. The first two words were fucking clients, which was our first bonding ritual. And then the second was X-Men.
Excellent.
He collected American X-Men action figures. And when I told him, I write comics sort of as a on the side, like I write comics sometimes. I was the coolest guy in the world.
That's outstanding.
But it was just seriously one of those things where, like, wow, is that a Wolverine action figure? X-Men. Okay.
That's great, man. You know, I read that Kansas City Star story. That,
oh, yeah, yeah.
That was great, which is how I knew that you had shaved recently, by the way.
Yeah, I tell you, nothing like appearing on the cover of a magazine to make you reconsider that decision to stop shaving and stop working out.
Well, I had no idea about your company, and were you with this company when they did the special effects for Stranger Than Fiction?
It was one of the last jobs I was connected with.
Wow.
I left before the job was completed.
Okay.
But I was there for the pitching phase and kind of getting the job in the door, and met with Mark and Matt and they're the design company, the digital effects house that he works with.
Well, that's great.
That was one of the last gigs I was connected with.
That's really cool. I got to see Emma Thompson and Maggie Gyllenhaal when they were in Chicago filming it.
Oh, nice.
They were downtown all the time. So, yeah, we'd, you know, run into them at movie theaters, really. I mean,
And Mark, you know, it was great. I mean, he's a really fantastic director, and he really had that was a real Chicago picture.
Yeah,
I mean?
Absolutely.
And not just, like, in a way that, like, oh, hey, look, we're in the Loop, and you turn a corner, and, you know, hey, look, we're on Lakeshore Drive, and, you know, you turn the corner, and, oh, look, it's the Hancock Building.
Like Running Scared, like the chase scene in Running Scared.
Yeah, exactly. one of my favorite things about Armageddon was Michael Bay's New York was four square blocks. During the court, Statue of Liberty.
Much easier to get around in the Armageddon New York.
Exactly. But that was such a great. Mark really celebrated the architecture of that town and the way it looked and the way it feels. And, you know what I mean? It was just. It's just such a great Chicago picture.
I love it, and I'm glad, speaking of another Chicago picture that's coming up pretty soon, I am sure New Yorkers are just tearing their hair out that Gotham City is really Chicago.
It was always really Chicago.
But then
I used to fucking live in Chicago.
Well, exactly. I mean, so, yeah, I think we have a Midwest bias or whatever. But, no, I mean, obviously, Tammany Hall, I mean, you know, corruption is nothing new to New York. And, I mean, I think certainly it has its share of Gothic buildings and stuff, but
I guess you're right. I guess I always, Metropolis was supposed to be Toronto. Is that right? wasn't the story that
not really.
Siegel had visited Toronto, and that was his inspiration for Metropolis.
Oh, that's interesting. I always assumed it was Kansas City because originally the Daily Planet, before it became the Daily Planet, was the Daily Star, just like the Kansas City Star. So I always kind of assumed, you know, even though eventually the DCU made Metropolis the cleaner, prettier New York,
I guess. There's New York in the DCU, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
That doesn't make sense.
It is confusing.
It should all be fake cities.
Well, I agree. See, I always thought Central City was Chicago. Keystone City was St. Louis to me.
I think Central City should be Kansas City because there's like Flash.
Well, that makes sense.
Flash is just too good-natured, and you know what I mean? That would be the sort of...
Yeah, I guess you're right. That does make more sense,
Flash is our most Midwestern hero.
Very true.
Flash is the superhero you could borrow a cup of sugar from, you know?
Definitely. Certainly Barry. Flash. And then
Flash,
I guess Wally.
Barry Allen is the man you would ask to dog sit. You know what I mean? Like you would trust Barry Allen with your dog.
And that's why they're bringing him back for the dead, because somebody needs to watch Crypto. God, Barry, I'm glad you're back.
Thanks, old chum. I've been dying to go on a vacation.
Let's call Jeff Johns.
Is Barry Allen faster than Crypto?
I think so. I think.
Are you sure?
Well, I know Wally is. I think Wally is once he's tapped into the Speed Force. But I always thought Barry really won those races. I mean, even when Barry and Superman would race each other. I mean, I always thought that, like, you know, because it was always for charity, they'd make it a tie. But I always thought that Barry could probably beat Superman if he really needed to.
Because it was always for charity, they made it a tie. Oh, God, I love comics.
I'm telling you, man. Oh, I'm geeked as hell that Barry Allen's coming back. I'll be honest. I don't care.
I wouldn't have known that Barry Allen was coming back if I hadn't read it in the New York Daily News. I read the DCU Zero, and I didn't get it. I felt like such a rube. I was like, well, thank God they got media coverage, because I wouldn't have fucking known. Jesus Christ.
The moon,
I thought it meant the red skies were coming back. I think guys didn't get it.
Oh, the lightning. Lightning bolt on the moon. Hell yeah, man. That screams Barry Allen, absolutely.
Well, what if just a lightning bolt in front of the moon? It could also scream Wally West.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. But Wally's already back.
It could have been Impulse. Fuck, who knows?
That's true. Bart. And then there's Bart.
Poor Bart.
Much like the Bart Maverick, you know? I mean, it's you know, it's like, yeah, you know, there's Brett and then there's Bart.
what a ridiculous waste of a character. That's such a bummer.
Well, as I've heard Dan say in many panels, you haven't seen the last of Bart, so I wouldn't worry. All right, back to the comic books. Punisher War Journal, man.
That is a comic book I am involved with.
I've heard that, and I joined the Jigsaw arc. That, you know what I like, and I you described the same thing going on in Iron Man, that you've kind of planted seeds, and there's going to be little stories and kind of leading up to the big, you know, the big arc that might be coming.
And this is sort of, we're at payoff time for Punisher.
Here.
This is really, I knew when I took over the book, I knew right away, like, well, you have to do like just a crazy Jigsaw story. If you're gonna make your stand on Punisher, do the ultimate Jigsaw story. You know what I mean? So that was sort of from day one, we've been building towards this kind of Punisher family idea that Jigsaw was assembling, and then his sort of master plan to bring Frank down. Working with my co-writer Rick Remender.
Yes.
Rather, co-writing with Rick Remender has been a dream, and it's made the book even sicker and even more warped and more damaged and more explosive than I ever could have hoped. And I'm just it is ridiculous fun, and I love it. I love writing it, and I'm happy that I'm finally able to tell this Jigsaw story. That all the pieces are finally on the board to do what I think is really sort of this is if I could make a if Rick and I could make a Punisher movie, it would be this one.
Well, I think it's great that Rick has come on board, because I know in one of my interviews with Rick, we were talking about you and Ed, mm-hmm. and he was shocked that you guys, as independent as you are in your storytelling and especially your own creator-owned projects, he was amazed at how well you fit into the Marvel Universe and were still able to, you know, retain your voices and not get submerged by continuity and the usual trappings that anyone finds themselves in when they're dealing with, you know, mainstream characters that are trademarks and, you know, you can only go so far. But so here is Rick now, not only, you know, doing this work with you, but also, you know, jumping on the Atom, and as I guess the curtain closes over there.
I was lucky when my Marvel stuff, I sort of always had a chaperone, whether it was kind of Axel at the beginning of Punisher War Journal, just because it was coming out of Civil War, or working with Ed on Iron Fist. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that helped sort of get me kind of up on my feet, maybe a little quicker than where had I been left alone. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Just having a guide, having a native tour guide there to kind of protect me and to shelter me and sort of show me the way to, you know, like I said earlier, Axel is a guy who wants good stories. You know what I mean? Axel is a guy, is for my money, one of the best editors in the industry. And for him to be the one that you sort of pop your Marvel cherry with, like, yeah, you're going to, I think I'm going to a much stronger writer for having gone around the block with Axel a few times than I would have been otherwise.
Well, he must really know how to take guys like you, Swazerski, Mike Benson, Charlie Houston, these guys that he has found, a lot of the novelists as well, that you know, he really must be able to translate the language of comics in a way that those guys get it. I know, obviously, you had been doing comics before. Rick has done comics before. But even just conveying the Marvel language.
Yeah, you know, and that's one of those things where, I mean, I think, you know, Axel hires writers first and foremost, mm-hmm. and understands that comics is a grammar that'll come, you know, but if you don't have the writing chops, you know, the rest of it won't show up.
Sure.
So he works with these guys and really, you know, guys that are quite accomplished, quite talented writers, clearly, and then is willing to hang with them and get them to a fighting weight for the Marvel Universe.
No, that's cool. You know, I'm gonna have to talk to Axel again. I interviewed him, I think, in 2006.
And Yeah,
and I should get him back because it was a good conversation.
He's terrific. He's just terrific.
Well,
I'm not alone in this. He really inspires the kind of like loyalty where, you know, you'd walk through a wall of fire for the guy. You know,
And I've heard people say that, not only you, but Brian Azzarello has said that about his time, you know, at 100 Bullets and Vertigo and everything. I mean, that's the thing. Axel's got the golden touch and has had it for a long time, and. You know,
I mean, Axel defined Vertigo in the 90s.
Absolutely.
I mean, from Preacher to Transmit to 100 Bullets, I mean, there's that sort of the last real golden era at Vertigo until now was really, you know, definitely I had Axel's fingerprints on.
No, I agree with you. I think, and that's one of the good moves that Joe made was to get him to come over to Marvel. I think that's great.
Yeah, you know, and I think you start to see, like, Will Dennis over there now really kind of building up a stable of creators.
Oh, absolutely. Here. Brian Wood and Jason, I mean, you know.
Jason Aaron, yeah. And, you know, G. Willow Wilson. Willow is a terrific writer.
Tell me about her, Matt, because I heard her on the panels from New York, and she sounded very interesting.
Yeah. I met her in her capacity as a journalist. She interviewed me, and she was living in, I believe, Egypt at the time. And is an American girl that married an Egyptian man, I believe, and converted to Islam, and is just such a unique, not a white guy that grew up reading comics in the basement perspective. she wrote a terrific, terrific debut graphic novel from Vertigo called Egypt last year.
Mm-hmm.
Shit.
I think it's.
I tell you, the one downside about a baby is my brain is just Swiss cheese.
Yeah, I think it's Cairo.
I think it's Cairo.
Yeah.
It is Cairo. I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah.
And now she's doing a book called Air, I believe.
Yes.
Which is sort of about flight, and she just has this just fantastic. Perspective and voice and experience and things to say that are different than guys who grew up reading Spider-Man and Batman, you know? And Jesus, we need more people like that.
Well, and I think she represents a new evolution over at Vertigo, because with that and...
Vertigo is really taking on a bit of an international, I hope it is really trying to take on an international flavor, and
even underground stuff too. I mean, opening the door for Picar and to come in with American Splendor, and even Jonathan Ames, the thing that he did with Dean Haspiel, this alcoholic story and everything. I mean, there's neat things going on at Vertigo beyond the stuff that they made their bones on, which is this great foundation of interesting fantasy and interesting horror, interesting crime. But now they're taking it to another level, and I know that. It's the one thing I respect about Joe. As much as he taunts DC and laughs at stuff, I know he has great respect for the Vertigo line, and I know one of the reasons bringing Axel over was to help Marvel along that direction. And I think the Max line has really grown up, and I'd love to see you do a Max book at some point, Matt. I think you're still able to kind of tell your own stories and everything in the places that you're able to.
I think sooner rather than later. Just between us girls, there's some stuff I'm cooking up. So.
Oh, excellent!
I would love to sink my teeth into that. Definitely.
That's great. Well, and to me, it the best Max stuff harkens back to what we were talking about earlier—that '70s black and white Marvel period.
Yeah.
Where it's adult stories and adult art, and not afraid to go places. And back to Punisher, again, I've said this before. Garth's Max run has been great. His Marvel Knights run was fantastic before it. And you are showing that there is room for a second Punisher book. And we all remember in the 90s, I mean, when it was early on, it was wonderful seeing a couple books like that. But there's always the fear of oversaturation. Yeah. But you are telling, it's the same guy, but it's definitely a different side to Frank Castle. And I love what's going on. And that it's not, even though it's a Marvel Knights book, and people are like, well, the Max book, you could swear in there and you could see stuff. And,
well, sure, you can. You can, absolutely, no doubt. And that's just not, that's art. Yeah, you totally can. Sure. Ours is a different book.
But it's still gritty and it's still very, crazy and I think interestingly and in violent ways. I told you before how much I adored all the spider villains and especially the Rhino.
Rhino has weirdly, strangely, surreally become a kind of moral center in that book. And when my stand on Punisher is done, if you look at Rhino in issue 4 and then in Hunter Hunted and then as he's going to come back again before too long.
Great.
Rhino has in his sweetly retarded rhinoceros way become sort of the moral hinge around which the book revolves. Frank showed him mercy. He showed him mercy because Rhino felt guilt and felt remorse, and that's something Frank's never been able to feel before, and now he's starting to feel it and kind of doesn't know what to do with it. So
wow.
In the end, I know it sounds goofy because I'm talking about a guy dressed up like a rhinoceros, but when we're done, you'll see what I'm talking about.
I think you kind of opened that door anyway. I loved the little handwritten note to the one victim's widow. It's like, here's some money.
Here's some money. I'll send you more money. I want to write a book. I want to write the Rhino and the Vulture like in a road trip.
George
like,
Lenny.
I want to turn them into like the Hope and Crosby of the Marvel Universe.
I don't know what we're doing here, Rhino, but let me tell you.
Where are we going? I don't know.
Boy, where the hell's Dorothy L'Amour in this picture? That's what I want to know.
Exactly.
God, I love Bob Hope. Don't get me started, Matt. Don't do that. I've enjoyed the little stories building up to this story, and I really like
even the weird ones.
Well, especially the weird ones.
At the end of Jigsaw, there's a little loose thread from the end of Hunter Hunted that's going to pop up again.
Very cool.
And it's just like I said, if Rhino comes back, it's all planned. It's all very. All this ridiculous stuff is, in fact, the result of a painstaking plan. So.
Well, and also, I'm just so happy that Chaykin is seeing so much mainstream work these days, and I'm glad that he is working with a guy like you, because there's definitely, despite the year's difference and everything, there's got to be some sort of mental link where you guys all speak the same language, because it's coming through in the book. I think there's some really funny stuff.
Chaykin, I think, gave birth to an entire generation of perverts like me and sick of weirdos. And, really, I've Chaykin to blame for a lot of my problems in life and the work that Chaykin did. And now I have a chance to really extract a little payback on the guy for... I'm just rambling at this point. I love Howard. I've been a Chaykin fan my entire life, and certainly my entire comics reading life. And to write for him now when he's really in this, I think, terrific and exciting phase of who he is sort of artistically is just a blast. And I love writing for him. And I knew kind of very early on that we were in this arc for Chaykin specifically, and that's just that's a gift, you know. That's just, oh great, we know it's going to be Howard, so great, let's have a good time. And I love writing for Howard, and I love the work he's been doing. And just buckle your seatbelts because Jigsaw is insane.
Well, that's cool. And Lady Punisher, and poor little Ian.
Huh?
Isn't that Ian?
Ian.
Yeah. Kid, as you call him, Kid Punisher?
Kid Punisher. In my notes, I call him Kid Punisher. Like in the script, Kid Punisher.
And yeah, his whole little trip and everything that, you know, started off as a very, you know, I loved his first appearance as the 9/11 kind of security guy, the faux cop.
Yeah, well, you know, it was my whole kind of Punisher. You know, Punisher is this, you know, he's a murderer.
Yeah.
That's his power. His power is he has no compunction about killing people. And it's kind of like, it's really hard to get your head around in a lot of ways. It's really hard to find your way into his humanity. It can be when you really kind of take it to its logical extreme. So my approach to this book was always kind of about the spaces around the Punisher. You know, it's as much about the Punisher as it is about the people he affects by being the Punisher. Ian, in particular, has been profoundly affected by that. And we're going to see sort of how deeply that goes. As Jigsaw continues.
I don't know how much we had a chance to talk about the fallout of Civil War and his confrontation with Bucky about taking over the, you know, him kind of adopting that faux Captain America uniform for a very specific reason.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of plays into where Frank's moral compass is. I mean, behind that killer, there is a method to his madness. He does have a point to him, and there are lines that he won't cross.
Yeah, and the thing with, you know, he's a guy who understands. I mean, look, you don't wear a giant white skull on your chest if you don't understand a thing or two about symbolism on some innate subconscious level. He's a guy who's everything about Frank is about symbol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is death's ultimate signifier, and that's a very big part of his theater of action, if you will. So to somebody desecrating to him what was a profound kind of icon, you fight fire with fire. It's not enough for him just to kill him as the Punisher. He has to kill him as, you know, as Captain America. But he's too unclean and too unpure to wear a straight-up Captain America uniform. You know what I mean? Like,
it's
all this kind of weird stuff that you can never, like, write out loud. You can't ever say that stuff out loud because you just sound like a crazy person. But, you know, like I said, there's a method to the madness.
Well, and also that even that confrontation where basically Bucky is saying, you're not fit to wear this uniform. And Frank's like, I know.
And Frank's response is like, yeah, no shit.
Yeah, exactly. Way ahead of you, kid.
Yeah, you think genius? Way to go. They didn't give you a robot brain with a robot arm, did they?
That was outstanding. No, that's the great thing, man. It's been great, and I'm enjoying the current story. Now it's payoff time. Like you said, you've planted all these little seeds, and now you hinted there that you said when I come to my end of my Punisher run, are we close?
We're getting there.
Okay.
There's Jigsaw. There will be a story, a little secret invasion tie-in, and then I believe my last arc is going to be called King Frank. And then I'm going to get out of the way and just let Rick tear it up.
That's great. Well, that's, again,
that's the plan. Best laid plans, you know, things might change, but that's the plan.
Okay. Well, that's cool. I mean, like I said, I'm enjoying the ride, and, you know, we'll equally look forward to Rick when he's flying solo, but,
Jigsaw and King Frank have been the destination from day one.
Interesting. King Frank. Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that when it unhatches, hatches out, so that'll be cool.
And I know Axel is near to message for King Frank, so believe me, you'll know when it happens.
That's great. Well, on that cue, we should wrap up. But I want to point out to listeners that in a scant few days, we will get a wrap up to the Casanova arc because we don't want to spoil what happened.
It is spoiler laden.
So by all means, keep your eyes peeled for next week, because there will be a special quickie word balloon as opposed to this 90-minute fraction extravaganza.
And I love that this is the edited version. I love that this is the, oh, well, we lost the one, so let's go through it. Let's just do it quick. We'll just recap everything real fast.
Oh, no.
Like, somehow this is even longer than last time.
No, it was about the same.
Oh, but, wow.
All right, so Matt, I thank you very much. And as we said, we unfortunately tried this the night before. It got destroyed. And then you were kind enough to come back and rant with me for another 90 minutes, so I appreciate
always.
It.
Always, and it felt like a whole new show, didn't it? It felt like I wasn't bored once.
Well, that's good. We came up with new things to talk about. And we'll have more to talk about next week and wrap up the Casanova arc and discuss that.
All right.
Part one of my talk with Matt Fraction. Make sure you come back in just a couple days for part two, where we'll be discussing the wrap-up to his second arc of Casanova. Issue 14 is out on Wednesday, the 14th. Pick it up, read it, and then come back here to Word Balloon as we discuss the entire story arc. This episode of Word Balloon was sponsored by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. They offer a huge selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at up to 35% off with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. And don't forget, you can pick up a lot of fraction trades at InStockTrades.com, among them the Punisher War Journal Volume 2, Going Out West, which was the arc that we were discussing about Frank and the Winter Soldier, Bucky Barnes, kind of disagreeing about the look that Frank took in his Captain America outfit and, you know, circumstances that led up to that. The regular retail price, $17.99, just $11.33 at InStock Trades. And don't forget to visit InStock Trades' sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at dcbservice.com for all your pre-order needs. Major publishers are 40% off. Monthly specials are 45 to 75% off each month. Visit InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at dcbservice.com. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress. Have a good evening, and don't forget to look for us all over the internet. Word Balloon is at newsarama.com. We're also available at iTunes, at our MySpace page, myspace.com/wordballoon, at our ComicSpace page, comicspace.com/wordballoon. And if you ever have any questions or comments about the show, feel free to reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, for part two of our conversation with Fraction, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2008.